Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, January 19th. We have an opportunity today to talk to the legendary Harvard constitutional law professor Lawrence Tribe, whose influence includes arguing dozens of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, having as students in his class at one time or another John Roberts and Elena Kagan, now on the Supreme Court, of course, those two, and Barack Obama when he was in law school. The Harvard Gazette writes, as a trusted advisor to Democratic presidents and party leaders, Tribe has influenced nominations to the Supreme Court for nearly half a century, from the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist to Justice Brett Kavanaugh, much to the delight and dismay of partisans, they write. And as much as Tribe can write long, detailed legal briefs for the Supreme Court and the groundbreaking textbook, American Constitutional Law, I see he is also very active in the 280-character form of scholarship known as Twitter. Two of his latest from the last day: Department of Justice absolutely must throw all its weight now into a grand jury pursuit of the guy at the top of the criminal conspiracy against the Constitution. I think you all know who that is. And he wrote, Gorsuch's refusal to mask up on the bench, even when asked by the Chief Justice to do so, in order that the diabetic and hence immunocompromised Justice Sotomayor could attend in person, shows just what kind of a jerk Gorsuch is. I wish he weren't a Harvard Law School alum, unquote. We'll ask Lawrence Tribe about that tweet as we go. The reason we have Professor Tribe today is because he will be a featured speaker tomorrow at the second annual State of Democracy Summit, hosted by the Belfer Center at the 92nd Street Y here in New York and Craig Newmark Philanthropies. It's a virtual summit, and you can register for free at 92y.org. Professor Tribe, it's an honor. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with a few of your tweets from the last day, if that's okay, and then we'll progress to longer texts. You tweeted, as I read, DOJ absolutely must throw all its weight now into a grand jury pursuit of the guy at the top of the criminal conspiracy against the Constitution. Obviously, that's about Trump. Do you think there's evidence of a crime regarding January 6th, as opposed to political lies about a stolen election, which might be protected free speech, or trying to get Congress to do some controversial things on January 6th?
I think that there is serious evidence of a crime, certainly more than enough evidence to have made it imperative for the Justice Department through the grand jury in Washington, D.C., to investigate all the way to the top. Among the crimes that it looks like the president apparently violated was corruptly impeding an official proceeding, a crime under 18 U.S. Code Section 1512, conspiring to forcibly hinder the execution of a federal law, which is seditious conspiracy, a violation of 18 U.S. Code Section 2384, and inciting insurrection or giving aid and comfort to those who do incite an insurrection, a violation of 18 U.S. Code Section 2383, punishable not only by imprisonment, but by permanent disqualification from office. And the more evidence that comes out from the extraordinarily active January 6th committee, the more we learn about the way in which these various criminal conspiracies interlocked. They were not only involved in the violent attack on our Capitol on January 6th, but they were involved in arm twisting of officials in the lead up to January 6th, in forging electoral certificates. The latest indication from one of the people indicted for insurrection is that there was communication back and forth between the Oval Office and the War Room in the Willard Hotel, and people who were engaged in trying to have a bloodless coup, and if that failed, a rather bloody one. So the criminal activity that needs to be investigated without any immunity for a former president or his closest aides is staring us in the face. And I worry that unless we get some indication, and sometimes these things do leak, you know, Washington isn't exactly leak-proof, unless we get some indication that serious investigations all the way to the top are already underway, the clock will run out. And the American people are bound to tell themselves, well, if nobody at the top has been indicted of a serious crime like seditious conspiracy or insurrection, then maybe the big lie wasn't a lie after all. And that falsehood will settle in and make it harder to have full accountability and make it more likely that we will be in even worse shape in the next election for president of the United States in 2024.
Do you think that Trump sat there for 3 hours, apparently watching the violent part of the insurrection on television and did nothing to call them off when they were doing this on his behalf, counts legally or could count legally as aid and comfort? You cited that provision.
I do think so. Liz Cheney made the point very clearly when she said that even though, and I'm just paraphrasing her, even though an ordinary citizen watching a violent attack and seeing Capitol officers pummeled and squeezed nearly to death and seeing a gallows, an ordinary citizen would have no obligation to come forward and couldn't be said to be helping to impede an official proceeding. The one person in the United States who has an affirmative obligation to execute the laws and whose failure to do so is rather like the failure of the fire chief to do anything when he sees a fire, is Donald Trump. Because under Article 2 of the Constitution, the president has the duty faithfully to execute the laws. And for him to just watch, and apparently, according to those who were with him, cheer as the violent crowd got ever more violent for a full, I think it was 187 minutes and do nothing, despite the pleas that were coming his way from his enablers at Fox News and from people in Congress who were helping and from his own family right to the chief of staff. His failure to do anything is not just like the ordinary omission. It's much more like the lifeguard not jumping into the water to save someone who is swimming. It's not like someone who is passing by on the beach.
Binnish in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe. Hello, Binnish.
Yes. Hi, sir. I was wondering if you could distinguish between, how to sort of think about prosecuting Trump under the Brandenburg principles versus, you know, in terms of inciting a riot and what you were talking about here. Is it the same thing? Because from what I understand, you know, the bar is very high when it comes to prosecuting anyone for inciting a riot.
Sure, I'd be glad to, Dennis. First of all, most of the prosecutions I talked about have nothing to do with his incitement at the Ellipse, but have to do with things like twisting Raffensperger's arm or trying to pressure the vice president or impeding the official proceeding of Congress. But with respect to giving aid and comfort and inciting the riot, the Brandenburg test that you're talking about, a Supreme Court opinion in 1969, itself said that there is a deep difference between advocacy in the abstract and incitement in the sense of fomenting violence. And if you look at all the context and the circumstances of what not only Trump, but Eastman and others who were at the Ellipse were doing, it certainly crosses the Brandenburg line. Equally important, the Brandenburg test was designed to protect ordinary citizens. In that case, as it happens, distasteful citizens, members of the Ku Klux Klan, protect private citizens when they are attacking and criticizing the government and other groups of people. It wasn't exactly designed to protect the head of the government when he or she incites a mob to attack another branch of the government. So I don't think the Brandenburg test is anything more than a talking point for the other side in this case. But in any event, The question of whether there is a First Amendment defense is properly raised at a trial. You don't have a trial without an indictment. You don't have an indictment without a serious investigation. And so far, although there are plenty of signs of serious investigation by this Department of Justice of the boots on the ground, they haven't quite reached the suits. The closest they've come is to the head of the one of the groups, the Proud Boys of the, I guess it was the Oath Keepers. So I honestly don't think the Brandenburg case is much of an obstacle to full criminal accountability.
Let's take another call. Here's Craig in Westchester. You're on WNYC with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe. Hi, Craig.
Hi. Thank you, Brian. And I'd love to hopefully expand the conversation. I know January 6th is possibly politically the most important thing to happen in the past 20 years, 50 years, or 100 years. But Trump has possibly done illegal things beyond that. For example, he was told by he was witnessed by the Attorney General, the Chief of Staff, and the White House Counsel when he was told he was being investigated by the FBI related to Russia's interference with the 2016 presidential election. All three of those officials witnessed him saying his famous quote, "Oh my God, this is terrible. This is the end of my presidency. I'm," and he used the word, you know, the F word. So that's more than a little suspicious, as people generally don't say things like that unless they know, in fact, they're guilty. Can't we assume that use this as a point of evidence for his guilt in other things like the Russian interference in our 2016 election? Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll mention that the New York State Attorney General made news just yesterday releasing evidence that Trump committed real estate fraud in New York. So we don't know where he's headed legally. But Professor Tribe, what would you say to the caller?
Well, I would say the caller is certainly right that there were serious crimes, probably of obstruction of justice, that related to attempts to cover up the way in which Trump became president in 2016 in the first place. The Mueller report identified 10 such instances. William J. Barr lied about them and made it look like he had gotten a clean bill of health. The statute of limitations on those possible crimes is about to run out this spring. I think the odds that Merrick Garland and this Justice Department will turn the clock back, even though they have the right and the power to, and I would argue the duty to, pretty slim. I think that their assumption seems to be that, you know, what's past is past, although I fear that what's past is prologue. There are all kinds of crimes that might be investigated, but the statute of limitations is running. And apart from that, there's another kind of clock that's running. It's a political clock. Unless we achieve full accountability soon, it's going to be really too late. Certainly after the midterm elections, it's not officially too late in the year following in 2023. But the point you made earlier, Brian, that it looks a little squishy to go after a political opponent, past president, it's going to look even worse if he's increasingly looking like a candidate for the presidency. Whatever hesitation people have about going after him now, they're going to have even more later. And, you know, these indictments don't always result in quick convictions. There was an indictment of people for seditious conspiracy. They were they went onto the Capitol floor and actually wounded a number of congressmen. They were Puerto Rican separatists. That happened in 1954. And within a year of that seditious conspiracy, they were indicted, tried, and sentenced to between 14 and 67 years in prison. But it seems that the wheels of justice don't grind quite so quickly these days. There's delay by everybody, delay by the Supreme Court in ruling on whether Trump has to turn over all the stuff, the archives, that is, have to turn over all of Trump's papers to the January 6th committee. The wheels of justice are grinding rather slowly at the Justice Department. And I do think that people should wake up. I mean, things don't have to be as slow as they seem to have been lately.
I want to turn to the Neil Gorsuch story that I mentioned in the intro that you tweeted about, that people are now tweeting us about and calling in about, that was broken by NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Listeners, if you didn't hear that story, she reported, quote, "With the Omicron surge and according to court sources, Sotomayor did not feel safe in close proximity to people who were unmasked." She has diabetes. Chief Justice John Roberts, understanding that, in some form, asked the other justices to mask up. They all did, except Gorsuch, who, as it happens, sits next to Sotomayor on the bench. His continued refusal since then has also meant that Sotomayor has not attended the justices' weekly conference in person, joining instead by telephone. That from Nina Totenberg's report on this on NPR. So you tweeted, Professor Tribe, that this incident shows what kind of a jerk Gorsuch is. Is that a legal term?
I think it's a technical legal term that we've developed at Harvard Law School for some of our graduates. But without being facetious about it, I do think it was really not only thoughtless, but hypocritical of him not to wear his mask. I mean, after all, he was one of the justices who voted that you cannot have that the OSHA cannot impose a workplace masking requirement without proof that there's something about the workplace, like the proximity of the individual workers, that makes this really a workplace risk. And I was imagining what the administration could do in response to that. What it could do, the president could direct OSHA to, among other things, have a rule that courts of all kinds, state, federal, where judges have to sit next to one another, must wear masks in order to facilitate the conduct of business without infecting their fellow jurists. Be interesting to see what Gorsuch would do in voting on a law like that.
Here's a call on this. Aaron in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hi, good morning, Brian, a longtime listener and 1978 graduate of Harvard Law School, best regards to Professor Tribe. I wanted to ask the professor, is there any possibility that Chief Justice Roberts can request of Justice Gorsuch that he be placed in a separate room distinct from the remaining justices, or that it would be he who should be directed to participate by telephone or some other manner so that he could still hear the oral arguments and participate directly but not be in proximity?
So who does the burden fall on, I guess, is the question, Professor?
Well, Chief Justice Roberts can certainly ask, but I imagine Gorsuch would say, quite correctly, you're not the boss of me. Not everybody knows, but the Chief Justice of the United States is not the employer or the boss of the associate justices. They all work for us, although sometimes they seem to forget that.
So a listener on Twitter asks on this topic, I assume that what Justice Gorsuch did, refused to wear a mask, is perfectly legal. Is there any legal course of action available to prevent or at least discourage such behavior in the future?
No. Other than the hypothetical law or regulation issued by OSHA saying that every workplace in the land, and the Supreme Court is, after all, a workplace, it's bound by various rules. The separation of powers does not entitle it to become rat infested or to become a fire hazard, that every workplace in the land must, when the circumstances require the kind of proximity that exists in a courthouse, impose masking requirements.
And I did want to ask you about the court striking down President Biden's vaccine mandate for all employers with 100 or more employees. They said, as I understand it, that it went beyond the authority of the ordering agency, which you just referred to, I think, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. To me, OSHA made sense because the mandate is first and foremost to protect people at the work site all day from repeated exposures to unvaccinated people. But I'm not a lawyer. But one thing that I was thinking as a parallel, and tell me why it wasn't for the majority of the justices, When New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg instituted his no smoking in restaurants policy, that one, too, was not to protect the health of patrons who could choose to eat at a different restaurant, but to protect the workers inside, industry-wide, who had no choice while on the job. Why didn't this fall into that category?
Well, it certainly would have. And if it had been a local or state rule, there's every indication that this court would have upheld it. It's upheld local and state mask and vaccine mandates. But the point is, it was a federal rule, and so the court said it needs authority from Congress. The only reason, however, that that didn't end the argument was that there was authority from Congress. Congress had passed a law decades ago authorizing the imposition of rules for workplace safety. It was broad enough to cover this particular regulation. The court didn't and couldn't deny it. So what did it say? Well, it said it's true that this rule does seem to fall within the broad congressional delegation, but we would like the delegation to be more narrowly tailored to COVID, perhaps, or to specifics of the year 2022. Well, that's lovely. Asking Congress to pass laws is already hard enough, but asking it to have a crystal ball is a little much. How could they have tailored it more narrowly? Now they're going to have a rule that is much more specific. Now they can do it in light of what we now know about COVID. But the right answer in that case would have been the rule is broad enough. OSHA has broad authority. And the fact, as the Supreme Court said, that the risk of COVID is not limited to workplaces seems to me to be completely beside the point. I can't think of any risk that is present only in a workplace. The risk of fire, the risk of falling down on a work ladder. You could fall down on a ladder at home when you're trying to fix your gutters. Yeah. It's kind of a ridiculous argument. It doesn't make sense on its own terms. It just shows how ideologically blind the court is these days, which is one of the reasons I think it needs to be enlarged, something that the Congressional Progressive Caucus just endorsed, something that several members of the President's Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States, on which I serve, have written op-eds urging, and something that I think needs to happen, even though the odds that it will happen with the current Congress are slim to none.
We're just about out of time. Let me ask you one final thing, kind of on a lighter note. I mentioned in the intro that you had Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Elena Kagan, President Obama, back when they were law students. When you were teaching,
and Merrick Garland, let's not forget Merrick Garland, whom I have been critical of in various ways, but supportive of others.
When you were teaching, and I realize you got the top of the top at Harvard Law School to begin with, but did you feel like you could spot the ones who are most likely to become important national figures?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I said it at the time. I didn't know that Barack Obama would become president, but I was sure he would do important things. Likewise, Elena Kagan, likewise, Merrick Garland, Adam Schiff, Jamie Raskin, any number of people. But the, you know, my best friends from way back include people you've never heard of, wonderful people. It's not only important public figures that are that count for things in this country. And I'm really honored and glad to have had the chance to teach so many wonderful people, as well as people who are a little less wonderful. Ted Cruz was one of my students, and I don't tend to brag about that.
Lawrence Tribe, Harvard Law professor. He will be a featured speaker tomorrow at the second annual State of Democracy Summit. It's a virtual summit hosted by the Belfer Center at the 92nd Street Y and Craig Newmark Philanthropies. It is also free, and you can register at 92y.org, 92y.org. Professor Tribe, thank you for giving us so much time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.